I'd like to begin with a question this afternoon. Are pre-Passover trials real? Now, we face trials at various times in our lives. They're not limited to one season of the year, that's for sure. However, in the church over the decades, part of our church speak, things that we might say to one another and understand that might be a bit foreign to those outside of the church, part of that church speak that has developed over time is the term pre-Passover trials or pre-feast trials. It's pretty generally accepted as true that in the time leading up to various seasons of the holy days, we should kind of hunker down and brace ourselves for impact because Satan is extra active. At least that's how it's always been presented or always come across at times to me. But is that true from a biblical perspective? Is there any support for this idea of pre-Passover trials being real? Or is it just a matter of perspective? We tend to notice things that we're paying attention to. When our awareness is heightened to a certain thing, we notice it more. For example, if you're considering buying a new car and you have your mind set on one particular make and model, it seems like all of a sudden you see everyone that drives by you. I didn't notice how many of these Volkswagen Beetles were driving on the highway until I was looking for one. Not really, just an example. Maybe when I was young and my brother's in the car, punch buggy black, no punch back. That kind of, right? Nobody else did that, never mind. Another example might be a couple years ago when we were finally able to return to services after not being together for a few months, with this concept of social distancing being something new for us at the time. Perhaps those initial weeks, you noticed a whole lot more how close people stood to you when they were talking than you ever really paid attention to before. I know at times I had some migrating conversations. Like, yeah. And then I'd end up on the other side of the room by the end of the conversation. Take a step back. Someone might move a little closer. Some people are just closer talkers, that's all. Something I never would have noticed until my awareness was heightened to it during that time. We tend to notice what we're focused on. So is that the case here with trials before the holy days? Is our awareness just heightened to them? Or is this something that actually has a scriptural basis? Are pre-Passover trials real? I want to look at this topic today from three different vantage points. First of all, from the vantage point of the example of the ancient Israelites. During the time leading up to the first Passover. Second, I want to look at the example of the apostles in the first century, leading up to the fulfillment of the deep meaning of Passover in the death of Jesus Christ. And then thirdly, we'll take a slightly different approach and look at the tactics of our adversary, Satan the devil. So let's jump right into this. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 4 as we begin here. And we've talked a lot about the upcoming Passover and the days of unleavened bread, but we haven't really dug into the story here in the book of Exodus much yet. So let's do a bit of that today. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 4. You know, God had already spoken to Moses at this point in the burning bush, through the burning bush, and told him that He was going to use him, Moses, to deliver his people out of Egypt. Of course, Moses responded by basically saying, you know, that's great, but you've got the wrong guy. Now, they're not going to believe me. Who am I? I'm not eloquent in speech. You're going to have to find somebody else to do this, God. To which God basically responded, pack your bags, Moses, you're going to Egypt. Here are a couple signs that you can use to show that I am working with you. You know, he was able to throw down his rod and it would turn into a snake. He was able to put his hand into his bosom and it would come out leprous and put it back inside and take it out and it would be healed. God gave him these miraculous signs to use as evidence. He also gave him his older brother, Aaron to be his spokesperson. We'll pick it up just after that in verse 28 of Exodus chapter 4. In verse 27, it says, "And the Lord said to Aaron, 'Go into the wilderness to meet Moses.' So he went and met him on the mountain of God and kissed him." I think that's just an interesting verse right there, that Aaron has no idea all this is going on, and God speaks to him and says, "Go out and find your brother. I have a job for you to do." I thought about that recently and thought, they were slaves in Egypt, but Aaron was just able to leave. Like, okay, I'm going to take a break. Going to Midian to see my brother. Well, even this verse itself is a miracle to me, that he was allowed to leave and go out and meet Moses. Verse 28, "So Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord who had sent him and all the signs which he had commanded him. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then he did the signs in the sight of the people." So they gathered the leaders from among the children of Israel. They told them what God had spoken to Moses, what he was going to do for them. In verse 31, "So the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel and that he had looked on their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshiped." And the people were humbled. They were appreciative when they realized that God had seen and he had heard. He had looked on their affliction. He knew exactly what they were going through. And he was going to deliver them. We see earlier in the account here that this was true, that God was aware of their suffering and the trial that they were going through. In fact, it's the reason that God cited when he was talking to Moses and when he said, "I'm going to use you to lead my people out of Egypt." Let's go back to chapter 3 and read that. Exodus chapter 3. We'll pick it up in verse 6, where God is speaking to Moses. Exodus 3, verse 6. "Moreover, he said, 'I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.' And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God." He had this deep reverence for God. "And the Lord said, 'I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and a large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt.'" Now God says clearly here in verse 7 that he knew what they were going through. "I have seen their oppression, I have heard their cry, and I know their sorrows." Was this time leading up to the first Passover a time of trial for God's people? It sure was when Moses was first sent. But that would change now, right? Let's go to chapter 5. Exodus chapter 5. Beginning in verse 1, this is right after the first passage we read about Moses and Aaron speaking to the elders in Israel, telling them that deliverance was coming. Chapter 5, verse 1. "Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness.' And Pharaoh said, 'Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go.' So they said, 'The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword.' Then the king of Egypt said to them, 'Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? Get back to your labor.' And Pharaoh said, 'Look, the people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labor. Now stop and think about this. The children of Israel were great in number. We estimate that including the women and children coming out of Egypt, it would be in the millions, a couple of million people perhaps. So how many able-bodied workers suddenly just stopped what they were supposed to be doing? You can see why Pharaoh would be saying, you know what, this Moses, this Aaron, this is not good for my workforce. All of a sudden they've stopped all this production because of you and your ideas about going out to sacrifice to your God. But you know what, this shows us that the people expected deliverance to come now. They didn't say, Moses, that's great. God's going to deliver us. We'll just keep plugging away here in Egypt, doing what we're supposed to do until he delivers us. They stopped. They expected deliverance to come immediately. That's often the case with our own trials too, isn't it? We want God to intervene, to shut it down, to turn things around and pull us from it now. That's not always the way he works. Continuing here in verse 6, so the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, you shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves, and you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. You shall not reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry out, saying, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let more work be laid on the men, that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. God knew their oppression. He had heard their cry. He knew their sorrows. Yet as they looked forward with this hope and this optimism toward their deliverance, they were met with greater trouble. More oppression. More demanding workloads. Verse 11, go get yourselves straw where you can find it, yet none of your work will be reduced. So the people were scattered abroad throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble instead of straw. You know, Pharaoh thought, well, they must have too much time on their hands. So don't give them the material they need to make these bricks. Keep the quota the same, but they're going to have to collect this straw, this stubble themselves. An increased workload. More of a trial when they were expecting deliverance. But verse 12, I think there's something there in verse 12 that's easy for us to overlook too. And that is the fact that it says here, so the people were scattered abroad throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble instead of straw. Part of having to collect this stubble to make straw, to make the bricks out of themselves, involved the people being separated a bit, scattered abroad throughout all the land of Egypt. Not only was their work more demanding, but they didn't have the camaraderie, the encouragement, the unity of having others nearby like they had before, at least not in the same way. What a good tactic to discourage the people, to try to put down this rebellion. Spread them out. You know, a couple of years back when we couldn't have services for a few months, our awareness was heightened to how important it is to be together and how much we need to be together as God's people to encourage each other, to push each other forward on this path to his kingdom, because it's easy to get discouraged by the trials and the challenges of life. Has that changed? It's been almost 2 years, or it is 2 years now since that time when we stopped having services. Have we kind of gotten just used to having church again, where maybe our awareness of how special it is to be together and important it is to be with God's people, has that kind of faded, worn off at all? Something for us to keep in mind, because that is part of what can make a trial difficult when you feel like you're going through it alone. In verse 13, and the taskmasters forced them to hurry, saying, fulfill your work, your daily quota, as when there was straw. Also the officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not fulfilled your task in making brick both yesterday and today as before? You know, add to this greater labor demand, the stress of being rushed. They were told, hurry up, come on, fulfill your daily quota. Get with it. The added stress of being rushed, of being put down, even of being beaten, we read here, when they were already exhausted. If we drop down to verse 19, now the taskmasters took this concern to Pharaoh. It's interesting there. Verse 14, the officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, they were the ones beaten. These were leaders among the children of Israel that were kind of set up to oversee the work that was to be done. So what was Pharaoh's strategy? Beat the taskmasters, oppress them more, and they'll pass it down the line. They'll oppress the people more. They'll be rushing them, urging them to do more. So these leaders take this concern to Pharaoh, and if we drop down to verse 19, it says, and the officers of the children of Israel saw, after they took this concern to Pharaoh, and he said, nope, I'm not changing the quota, they saw that they were in trouble. After it was said, you shall not reduce any bricks from your daily quota. Now they knew they were really in for it. Then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them. And they said to them, let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. So Moses returned to the Lord and said, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Why is it you have sent me? You said you were going to send me to deliver these people from the oppression. You had heard their cry. You knew their sorrows. And yet now they're going through more than they were before. I can understand, can relate to the frustration of the Israelites and of Moses here. Verse 23, for since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered your people at all. Seems like Moses expected quick deliverance as well, didn't he? Not only were there trials leading up to this time of the Passover for the Israelites, the trials were intensifying. They saw that they were in trouble and the people were feeling discouraged. They were beginning to feel like God had failed them. It certainly was a time of trial. Chapter 6, beginning in verse 5, we'll pick it up here. God's trying to provide some hope, telling them not to give up. Exodus chapter 6, verse 5. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Therefore say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Then you shall know I am the Lord your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I'm going to deliver you, just perhaps not on your timetable. Verse 8, and I will bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Lord. So Moses spoke thus to the children of Israel, but they did not heed Moses because of anguish of spirit and cruel bondage. Now God offered them this hope, this light at the end of the tunnel. It's going to be okay. I am going to deliver you. But their anguish of spirit was so strong that they would not even allow this promise to comfort them. They were at the lowest of lows, weren't they? Not quite. Not quite. If we continue in chapter 7, we'll just highlight what happens there. The 10 plagues began, and fresh water was turned into blood. The fish that were in the river died, and the river stank. The Egyptians had to go and dig around the river to try to find a source of fresh water to drink. And we think it's difficult if we have to get up, walk all the way across to the house, turn on the faucet, and get our water. In chapter 8, the second plague begins, and frogs covered the land. Imagine what this must have been like. Even if you're an animal person, even if you walk up and pick up one of those gross things like my wife and children do. Imagine frogs in your house, in your bed, in your oven, and in your kneading bowls. It's disgusting. And you know what? When God ended the plague, he didn't end it by having all the frogs just happily hop back to the river and get in the water. When he ended the second plague, it says that the frogs died and they had to be gathered up into heaps. Piles, heaps of dead frogs. And it says in verse 14 of chapter 8, and the land stank. Probably smelled just about how you would expect a pile of dead frogs to smell. They were thirsty, tired, probably disgusted by the stench. Later in chapter 8, the third plague of lice begins. Lice on man and beast. So you're already thirsty. You're already kind of grossed out, this foul smell in the air. And now you're going to have these little bugs on you, making you itchy and uncomfortable. Then the fourth plague is foretold. Swarms of flies will be sent if Pharaoh refuses to let the people go. I have a little bit of a taste of what that must have been like because the flies are crazy at our house last summer. They're just everywhere. So, sure, it was way worse than country living flies. Swarms of flies. But notice here in chapter 8, beginning in verse 22. In the middle of this description about this fourth plague, the swarms of flies, verse 22 of chapter 8. And in that day I will set apart the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell. And that was the area that Jacob and his sons, their descendants, were given to dwell in when Joseph was living in Egypt. During the famine in the land, Jacob and his brothers were invited to come dwell in Goshen. In that day I will set apart the land of Goshen in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, in order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land. I will make a difference between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign shall be. And the Lord did so. Thick swarms of flies came into the house of Pharaoh, into his servants' houses, and into all the land of Egypt. The land was corrupted because of the swarms of flies. But did you notice a couple of phrases there in that short passage? In that day, I will set apart the land of Goshen. I will make a difference between my people and your people. Well, what does that mean? That means that not only was Israel being oppressed and mistreated, not only was their labor increased while they were being rushed and belittled and even beaten for not fulfilling the quota expected of them, and also being scattered further apart from one another, they also experienced the first three plagues. God says here in the midst of the fourth plague, in that day, I will make a distinction between my people and your people. In that day, I will set apart the land of Goshen. That means the water to blood, the having to go out and dig for fresh water to drink. Israelites had to experience that. The frogs, even in their house, in their beds, in their cookware, the Israelites had to deal with that. And even the lice. Evidently, they were subject to these first three plagues along with the Egyptians because this distinction wasn't made until the fourth. Were there some pre-Passover trials going on for ancient Israel? Absolutely. And although God made this distinction between Israel and Egypt from this point going forward, how do you think that affected their oppression? If your enemy, your captor, is experiencing all this suffering of these other plagues, and he sees, you don't have to go through this. God's protecting you from these things. How do you think that was going to change Pharaoh's disposition to the Israelites? Well, one of two things would happen. He would either see he was wrong and give in and free God's people, or he would become more harsh and more oppressive out of frustration. The trial continued. But let's shift gears now to the first century AD. The time of Jesus Christ and that final Passover he kept while in the flesh. AD 31. Did the disciples of Christ, specifically the 12, the apostles, did they experience pre-Passover trials? Let's go to Matthew 26. Matthew 26. We'll begin in verse 1. Matthew 26, beginning in verse 1. Now it came to pass, when Jesus had finished all these sayings, that he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. Then the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. But they said, 'Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people.'" And the hypocrisy in verse 5 just kills me. Let's not murder this guy during the feast. I mean, that wouldn't be good. People probably wouldn't like that. But let's plot to kill him some other time. But in verse 2, this gives us a hint at what the disciples, the 12, must have been going through at this time. Because 2 days before the Passover, he says, "I'm going to be delivered up and crucified." The religious leaders were already plotting against him to make it happen. Now put yourself in the shoes of one of his disciples at that time. What would you be thinking? You had heard the prophecies all your life that Messiah would come, that he would deliver you. And you were convinced that this man was the prophesied Messiah. You had spent the last 3.5 years with him, learning who he really was and what he was capable of. But now he's telling you, "In 2 days, I'm going to be crucified and killed." Is it a stretch to say that the disciples were enduring a trial of stress, anxiety, confusion, emotional turmoil leading up to the Passover? Now, this wasn't new knowledge. It's something that Jesus had tried to tell his disciples about previously. If we go back to Matthew 16, back 10 chapters earlier, Matthew 16, we read here that he had been telling them for quite some time what was going to happen to them, but their eyes were not open to see and understand it yet. Matthew 16, beginning in verse 21. Verse 21, "From that time Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, 'Far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you.' But he turned and said to Peter, 'Get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me, for you're not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. You don't even realize who's influencing you to say these things right now.'" He had foretold of his death for quite some time, but they didn't understand it. They didn't want to believe it. Peter had been told that by resisting this truth, he was being influenced by Satan himself. Again, put yourself in his shoes. If your friend, your leader, your Messiah said to you, "Get behind me, Satan," You don't even know what you're talking about. A stressful time, I would say so. And then flash forward to Matthew 26 that we already read. Now he's saying this is going to happen in 2 days. After 2 days is the Passover and the Son of Man will be crucified. Now think about that. Just personalize it in your own life. What if a close friend of yours said, 2 days from now, I'm going to be tortured and killed? What? It would be confusing. It would be a stressful, emotional time. Amplify that by the fact that he wasn't just a close friend or mentor. He was someone they had spent 3.5 years with, learning from, someone they had grown to rely on for his guidance and his counsel and his teaching, someone they truly felt like they couldn't live without. This was a time of mental and emotional trial for his disciples. Let's go to Mark 14. And consider what they must have been going through on the night of the Passover. Mark 14. Begin in verse 17. His disciples had gone and found the place where the Passover was to take place, prepared it. In verse 17 of Mark 14, in the evening he came with the 12. Now as they sat and ate, again, put yourself here in this scene, enjoying a special meal on a solemn, sobering evening, the beginning of the annual Passover. And your friend says, assuredly I say to you, one of you who eats with me will betray me. And they began to be sorrowful and to say to him one by one, is it I? And another said, is it I? He answered and said to them, it is one of the 12 who dips with me in the dish. In one of the other gospel accounts, I believe it's John's account, it says Peter kind of motioned to John, ask him who it is. And John leans back, kind of whispers to Christ, it seems like, and says, which one of the 12? He says, the one to whom I give this bread. And he apparently dips the bread and hands it to Judas. So John was in the know. He knew who it was who would betray him. Verse 21, though, the Son of Man indeed goes just as it is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had never been born. Now, I've been at some awkward family meals. We could kind of feel the tension in the air. I don't think any of them relate to this. Oh, happy Passover. By the way, one of you is going to betray me, and it would be good if you were never born. Time of trial? Time of mental, emotional distress? Confusion? I'd say so. Not only were they trying to wrap their minds around the fact that he said he was going to be crucified, and now that day was beginning when he said it was going to happen, now they had this heart-wrenching news that it would be one of them, one of their close friends, one of their comrades, their confidants, who would be the one to betray him. They go through the rest of the evening, they take of the bread and the wine, these New Testament symbols of Passover that they didn't fully comprehend on that night. When they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives, and we'll pick it up in verse 27. Mark 14, verse 27. Then Jesus said to them, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. Peter said to him, even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be. Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." But he spoke more vehemently, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And they all said likewise. This wasn't just Peter's opinion. The entire group now, Judas had already left at this point. But the 11, they all said, "We're not going to deny you. What are you talking about? We love you. We know who you are. We believe you." And then verse 32. Then they came to a place which was named Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." Emily and I have had the privilege of sitting in this very place, at least what is said or believed to be the location of the Garden of Gethsemane. I know some others in this room have been on a trip to Israel, have done the same. You sit amongst these olive trees, hundreds of years old, and you can look out and see the city of Jerusalem, right where the temple was. You'd be looking out right where everything was going to go down. He tells his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." Verse 33, and he took Peter, James, and John with him. He wanted his close friends with him during this time of stress. And he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch." Do you think they had ever seen Jesus like that before? Probably not. That would have added to the stress of this trial. When the people we love and care about are going through a trial, it's a trial for us too. And they were seeing Jesus experience this for the first time, perhaps. Verse 35, he went a little farther and fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will." Even the King of Kings fell to his knees and asked to be delivered from this situation, from this trial he was facing, if it was at all possible in God's plan. Can Jesus Christ relate to the trials that we go through? He was God in the flesh, and he fell on his knees and prayed to the Father that he would be delivered. And you know what? The answer was no. This is how it has to be to fulfill my plan. It's why he can sympathize with us in everything we go through, because he knows what it's like to even receive a no. Verse 37, then he came and he found them sleeping and said to Peter, "Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Luke's account adds an important detail here. If you go over to Luke 22 with me, an important detail about him finding them sleeping. Luke 22, we'll pick it up in verse 44. Luke 22, verse 44, after he had prayed this prayer that if it was possible for God to take this cup away from him, that he would do so. Verse 43 says, an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. And verse 44, and being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. When he rose up from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them sleeping from sorrow. And he didn't find them sleeping because it had been a long day. He didn't find them sleeping because they had eaten a little bit too much at dinner time and they were so full they just couldn't keep their eyes open. He found them sleeping from sorrow. They were emotionally exhausted by thinking about all of the things that he said were going to happen and what they might mean. He tells them here, rise and pray, lest you enter into temptation. That word translated temptation, according to Thayer's Greek lexicon, has a number of different possible definitions listed there. The first one for temptation says, an experiment, attempt, trial, or proving. Rise and pray, lest you enter into trial. Definition 1b says, the trial of man's fidelity or integrity, virtue, or constancy. Rise and pray, lest you enter into a trial of how committed you are. A trial that could test your faith. And definition 1b3 says, of the condition of things or a mental state by which we are enticed to sin or to lapse from the faith and holiness. So much wrapped into this word temptation. But in other words, he was telling his disciples who were sleeping from sorrow, rise and pray lest you be overtaken by this trial and lose faith and give up. Think about what happened from there. We won't read through all the details, but we know the overarching thread of the story. They see their friend, Judas, show up in the Garden of Gethsemane, betraying Jesus with a kiss and handing him over to the leaders who were seeking to kill him. They all flee in fear, abandoning Christ exactly as he said they would. At least some of them return, though, to the scene. At least John and Peter we know of were present, were nearby, where Jesus Christ was experiencing being questioned, being beaten, being spit upon, being tortured. And his disciples were seeing at least portions of that happen. Isaiah 52:14 says, this prophecy of the Messiah who was to come says, so his visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. This is a prophecy of the suffering that Jesus would have to go through. It's basically saying he's going to be beaten to the point of not even being recognizable, to the point of not even looking human anymore. And Peter watches from afar, three times denies being one of Christ's disciples, and the rooster crows. And Luke 22, verse 61, we'll pick it up right there. Verse 61, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter. What must that look have felt like? To know he had abandoned his close friend in his greatest time of distress and need. That he had denied him. I imagine there was some compassion in the eyes of Jesus Christ. It wasn't a, I told you so, look, at least from my perspective, and from what we know about the character of Jesus Christ, more of one of those piercing looks like that of a parent when you know you've disappointed him. In verse 62, so Peter went out and wept bitterly. A time of trial? I think that's an understatement. Then at least some, if not all, of his disciples went on to then witness Jesus being nailed to a stake. We know that John was there at least, because while he was on the cross, one of his last seven statements that Jesus made was talking directly to John. And instructing John to take care of Jesus' mother. I would venture to guess John probably wasn't the only one of the remaining 11 who was there at the scene, who just, as much as you don't want to see what's happening, you just have to go find out what's going on. Imagine watching your friend, the one who you knew and believed was your king and your Messiah, being tortured and breathing his last breath. Add to this another component that maybe we don't think about too much. On top of all of that, they also eventually get news of the fact that their other friend, Judas, and they spent 3 years with him too. They get news of the fact that not only had he betrayed Christ, but he felt so guilty about what he had done that he didn't fall on his knees and ask for God's mercy in repentance. No, he felt so guilty about what he had done and felt like there was no way out. So he went and hung himself. Another aspect of this trial for the disciples. Losing two friends, really. One who wasn't quite what you thought he was, and one who was exactly who you knew he was, but you couldn't quite understand why this was happening. This time surrounding, leading up to, including the Passover in AD 31 was most definitely a time of trial for the apostles, absolutely. As was that first Passover in Egypt. Does that necessarily mean that times leading up to the Passover are still times of trial for us? Let's consider that last vantage point. This one will be much shorter, promise. That is the tactics of our adversary, Satan the devil. You can turn to 1 Peter 5 with me if you'd like to. We've referenced this in another message recently. That seems to happen a lot. That's okay. The Word of God is living and powerful. It doesn't get used up. There's always something else we can learn and glean and look at. 1 Peter 5, verse 8 is really what we want to take note of when it comes to Satan's tactics, something we've already talked about a few weeks back. But I can't help but start at verse 6. The context. Verse 6, 1 Peter 5. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. The context of verse 8 that we're about to read is relying on God during times of trial. Humbling ourselves so that we can rely on him during times of trial. Verse 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. As I mentioned recently, how does a roaring lion go after his prey? Well, in a sneaky way. Crouching in the tall grass, observing for a while, seeing what would be his best approach, his best attack, waiting patiently for the right time to strike. How does a lion decide which animal in a herd to go after? Well, probably by watching for a while, considering which one will I be able to catch? Which one seems off guard or distracted or weak? Which one is on the outskirts of the pack and maybe a little disconnected from the others and unexpected? You know, Satan is likewise strategic in his attacks. We see that in Luke chapter 4 as well. In Luke chapter 4, we have this story here of Satan tempting Jesus Christ. Another passage we've kind of nibbled around the edges of recently. And we'll do a little nibbling today as well. Luke chapter 4. This is right after Jesus Christ had been baptized by John the Baptist as an example for us. Luke chapter 4, verse 1. Then Jesus, being filled with the Holy Spirit, returned from the Jordan and was led by the Spirit into the wilderness. Now, he was prompted through the Holy Spirit to just seek a quiet place for a while, have some special time with God. Verse 2, being tempted for 40 days by the devil. So he was led by the Spirit into the wilderness, being tempted for 40 days by the devil. And in those days he ate nothing, and afterward, when they had ended, he was hungry. Now, we usually read this account, whether it's this one or Matthew's account, or Mark mentions it briefly as well. It's easy to read these three temptations, these three attacks of Satan against Jesus Christ, and think, all right, he attacked Christ after 40 days of fasting. Absolutely true. That's when these three temptations were brought before Christ. But verse 2 says, being tempted for 40 days by the devil. I don't think it was just these three attacks that Satan tried against Jesus. They might have been the culmination coming after the 40 days of fasting, but it says for 40 days he was being tempted by the devil. He doesn't just attack at one time, one season of the year. He's relentless. He'll try over and over again. Now, at times, we go through trials that aren't necessarily caused by Satan. We experience trials that are a result of time and chance. Sometimes even trials that are results of our own decisions we've made that God allows us to reap the consequences of. But there are times when God allows Satan to use trials as direct attacks against us. Think about the book of Job, for example. Satan is relentless, but he's also strategic. Now, why did he muster up that triple attack, these three temptations at the end of the 40 days? Because Jesus was hungry. And from Satan's perspective, he was bringing the heat when Jesus would have been physically the weakest. Yet he was spiritually stronger than ever, because he had just humbly drawn near to his Father during these 40 days. Notice verse 13, though, after these three temptations. Verse 13, now when the devil had ended every temptation, again, another indication that it wasn't just these three things, when he had ended every temptation, he departed from him until an opportune time. He wasn't done. He was just taking a step back to consider his strategies and think about when might be another time to attack. And although our adversary is relentless, he is also strategic. He's opportunistic. He's looking for the perfect times to try to tempt us, to distress us, to oppress us with greater intensity. Is the time leading up to Passover one of those opportune times in his mind? Perhaps. It would certainly make sense for him to see this as an opportune time to attack the people of God, if for no other reason than simply to distract us from what God wants us to be focused on. His attacks aren't limited to this season, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if they are intensified. And it would fit with the example of ancient Israel and what the apostles went through leading up to Christ's death. But I didn't cover this material to try to say, brace yourselves, brethren. I covered this material because there's a common thread in all three of these examples that should give us encouragement and hope. The common thread is this. In each account, children of Israel being prepared to depart from Egypt, the time leading up to Jesus Christ's death, even this temptation account when Satan tried to attack Christ. In each of those accounts, there was also the recording of a humble experience of drawing near to God and yielding to Him. all three of these accounts involve times of trial and testing, but all three of them also involved humbly yielding to God and being drawn near to Him. And ultimately, that's what empowered the people of God to endure the trials that they suffered. Think about it. For ancient Israel, they experienced this oppression, this suffering, this forced labor intensifying, even the first few plagues. And in the midst of the suffering and the trial they faced, God commanded them to stop, kill a lamb, paint the blood of the lamb on your doorpost, and just stay home tonight. He warned them about this 10th plague, the death of the firstborn. He said, don't come out until morning, and I'll deliver you, I'll protect you. They submitted to God's instruction, knowing, believing that everyone outside their homes that night would experience this loss and this devastation of the death of the firstborn. And if we go back to Exodus 12, let's read verses 29 and 30. Exodus 12, verse 29. Exodus 12, verse 29. And it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he, all his servants, and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, and there was not a house where there was not one dead. You think the children of Israel heard this cry? Every house in an entire nation experiencing the death of the firstborn? And yet, they had stayed in their homes, humbly, prayerfully asking God to deliver them as He promised. I imagine it was a sober, humbly evening of prayer and of drawing near to God. And when they yielded to His instructions and they waited on Him, they were delivered. Not only were they protected from this final plague, the next night they were also delivered from the land of their captivity and were allowed to depart from Egypt. But that came when they had this experience of being drawn close to God, this sobering, humbling experience of spending that night in their homes, thinking, praying about the deliverance He promised. That experience gave them the courage to then move forward from here when they were delivered from the land. The apostles experienced something similar. In the midst of their confusion, of their mental and emotional distress that led up to the Passover and included the Passover, you know what they also experienced? John 13, beginning in verse 2. John 13, verse 2. And supper being ended, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into His hands, that He had come from God and was going to God. In other words, Jesus, knowing exactly who He was, what He was about to accomplish, and where He would end up as a result, rose from supper and laid aside His garments, took a towel and girded Himself. After that, He poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which He was girded. Every year at Passover, I try to put myself in that scene. What if my God, my Messiah, my Savior, was the one kneeling before me washing my feet right now? That's what they experienced. God in the flesh, their Creator, the Messiah, the one they believed would be their King, in the midst of all this turmoil and this emotional stress of this trial, girded Himself and served them, washed them clean. There was this incredible event that would draw them near to Him. I imagine this, too, was a humbling experience that brought them even closer to the God they loved, just like that experience of being protected in their homes humbled and drew the Israelites closer to God in the midst of that trial. They didn't know what everything that was happening or that would happen that night meant at that time. But in the midst of it all, they were forced to pause, yield to God, and experience this humbling and unifying event. And even in the example of Jesus Christ's temptation, that's not an account, by the way, that is necessarily associated with leading up to Passover or the spring holy days. But in that account, where we learn about Satan's tactics, relentlessly and opportunistically pursuing God's people, Satan thought that was an opportune time, but it was actually a time of trial that Jesus was given the spiritual strength he needed to endure. Why? How? Because he had humbled himself and he had been drawing near to God through fasting. See, in all three of these accounts, there's this humble drawing near to God. Regardless of the time of the year or the circumstances of the trials we face, it's only in humbly yielding to God and drawing near to Him that we'll be delivered. It's in humbly drawing near to Him that we're strengthened and given the ability that we need to endure the trials we face. We don't always know the purpose of those trials, what they're going to lead, or the magnitude of what's going to come from them. You know, put yourself in the shoes of the Israelites and of the apostles again. They didn't know the end result of those incredible trials they were facing. But God gave them the strength to endure when they yielded to Him. And the same is true for us. Psalm 34, verse 19. Psalm 34, verse 19, a psalm of David. In verse 19 says, many are the afflictions of the righteous. Not just in one season of the year, not just one period of our lives. They certainly do intensify at times. But many are the afflictions of the righteous. But the Lord delivers him out of them all. As we yield to Him, as we rely on Him. Historically, in these accounts we've talked about today, we do see times of trial and stress associated with the spring holy days. And it would be no surprise to me at all if Satan sees this season of the year as an opportune time to try to attack and discourage and distract us. But you know what's even more clearly defined in Scripture about this season of the year? That it's a time of deliverance. It's a time of rescue. It's a time of redemption of the people of God. Let's be reminded of that description of this time of year. Rather than focusing on pre-Passover trials or wondering what's going to come next, what do I need to brace myself for, let's focus our attention on the message of deliverance that is central to the meaning of the Passover. Whether trials really are more prevalent this time of year or just a matter of heightened awareness, let's remember that it's only in humbly drawing near to God and yielding to Him that we will ultimately be delivered. Whether that be being delivered from the trial or being delivered through it. And the events of the Passover service are humbling themselves. Going to Passover, remembering Christ's death in our place, experiencing the foot washing and taking of the bread and the wine. That's humbling itself. But fasting is also a tool that we can use to humble ourselves and draw near to God. Whether we're feeling the pressure of pre-Passover trials or not, I want to encourage each of us to put this tool to use prior to Passover. Set aside a day between now and Passover to purposefully be humbled and strengthened. Let's never forget that this isn't just a common time for trials, but a season of deliverance. And as we approach the Passover in just under 4 weeks, may your trials be few, but may your unity with our deliverer be mighty.